There you are.
Thank you very much, and thanks to the organizers who brought us together here. I think it's a very exciting event. As you see from my title, I want to talk about native systems, actually, so I'm the least applied, I'm sure, the least applied person in that whole room. But we just recently started working on applied systems, but I wanted to sort of share with you what we have learned from studying chemical ecology of plant defenses in natural systems and how we may apply those. And the entire talk is pretty much based on what we thought about when we sort of started those new applied systems, which are primarily tomatoes, where we try to breed or hybridize domesticated tomatoes with wild tomatoes in order to get certain defense traits of wild tomatoes into domesticated tomatoes. This is one project. And the other one that we will soon start with Seo Khan, who's speaking right after me, hopefully on sorghum. But what I was worried about was that we, for decades now, we talk about using plant natural defenses in agriculture in a larger, on a larger scale, but yet we have to see that success to come about. So we don't see large-scale application in conventional agriculture of natural plant defenses. Although we have made a lot of progress in plant breeding as well as in IPM, where we see those successes going. But we were thinking about why that actually is. There were two major reasons for that. One is when you look, and I just had this spraying airplane as an example for conventional agriculture. I know it's not always that way, but in principle, that is the way in the more industrialized agricultural realm. But important thing is that doing that is very easy to apply, and you see immediately the effect. And so it's very efficient. And even though we have certain costs associated with that, and those costs are primarily those associated with the impact on human and environmental health, as well as that we think that they are on all levels pretty much, socially, economically, and environmentally not sustainable into the future. Because, and I kind of marked that with the costs here, for us in the developed world, the economic costs of using those conventional agricultural methods are very cheap, right? And this is only because both oil, so the energy associated with the production, are subsidized, as well as the agriculture itself is subsidized. So in developed countries, you often run into that problem, and this is our experience that we do now with the tomatoes in Peru, for example, that you know, buying a pesticide is actually not affordable. And so a theoretic option is then working with a natural system, with the natural plant defenses, in order to overcome those problems. But then, and this is the second problem, and this is probably the major reason why we don't see much of an application of natural plant defenses in broad, big-scale agriculture, is that those natural systems are very complex. And complexity has some intrinsic properties. For example, that you, if you take something away from that complex system, you cannot predict what the outcome of that will be. Or if you change, for example, certain resistance traits in a plant through breeding or through genetic transformation, you cannot necessarily predict the higher level community interactions, in particular in the insect interactions, the alpha pool community associated with those plants. However, the economic cost, it's again, I have a question mark here. If labor costs are cheap, this is extremely cheap, right? And we can assume that there is relatively low, if no, impact on human and environmental health. And therefore, it's very sustainable. Now, the question was that we sort of started with to ask, are there certain principles that we can learn from natural systems as well as from applied systems about natural plant defenses that can help us to cope with that complexity, right? Because if you want to cope with complexity, you have to understand the interaction rather than the function of each single piece in the entire system, right? And so we came up with some principles of natural plant defenses, which will not be new to you, but I kind of want to present them in a different framework a little bit before I go into some examples. We can identify principles of plant defenses through which we can affect those complex interactions by influencing the mechanisms that drive the complexity, right? So one thing is very, very natural, the direct defenses of the plant. they fall into three categories. They're toxic, anti-digestive, and anti-nutritive, and they are sorted by their effect on generalists and specialists. The toxic ones mostly functioning against the generalist herbivores, while the other ones can function against all of them. While saying that, it becomes immediately obvious that not every plant defense is functioning the same way against every insect pest, right? And so we have to know about the systems that we work with, whether or not we have multiple pests, and whether or not those multiple pests respond differently or the same way to certain secondary metabolites in the plants that we eventually want to breed for. The second thing is, I wrote here volatile organic compound emission, but I primarily leave that as a placeholder for information mediation within the common complex communities. So I'm just saying that there is information mediated between the organisms interacting in that community, and we can sort of tap into that information. And if we can do that, we can influence things like the herbivore's host choice, which is often dependent on the volatile emission, especially long-range attraction of herbivores. And you will, I think you will hear some about that from Sarah Kahn and his exciting system later on. We can attract predators, the so-called indirect resistance, and something that I want to sort of hint on today in an example, something that could be much more utilized, I think, is the interaction between plants. So volatile-mediated induced resistance in plants that are neighboring already damaged plants. Now, the third one is I put in competition, and I mean competition with weeds, for example, in an agricultural setting, and with any type of neighbors in a natural setting, which can come either in competition for just space while, you know, out-competing by growing or producing chemicals that inhibit the growth of the neighbors. And we have to include competition in our framework of controlling pests via natural defenses because competition and resistance are very closely linked ecologically. Right? So we always have to account for those. And now the fourth and last point that I want to bring up is that we assume a co-evolutionary arms race between the antagonists, in our case insect herbivores, and the plant, which again sort of we can derive some additional principles from that. And this is, as you can see, that's interacting with everything above here. There's one thing that co-evolutionary arms race can result in local adaptation, and associated with that in novel weapons if you bring a new plant into a new environment, right, where the alpha pro community is not adapted to those secondary metabolites. In a way, you may say this had happened, you know, local adaptation kind of breeding has happened for like 10,000 years before we actually started modern agriculture, more or less. We tried to breed for local adaptation, and this is part of that. But we can use that in biological pest control and IPM by exposing primarily species that produce compounds that you not usually find in the natural systems. Induced resistance is an emergent property of the co-evolutionary arms race, and I will talk about that in more detail in a second with the examples. And there is, and this is one of the a major focus of our research in my lab, is understanding why functionally we have such a high diversity of secondary metabolites, and whether or not that high diversity is in fact functional. So are multiple compounds produced by a plant redundant in their function, or are there synergistic interactions? If we know that, we can use that knowledge to apply it in a plant breeding program and then eventually manipulate the mechanism with which we can control the pests more efficiently. Now, all of those things, as I mentioned in the beginning already, are subject to complex trait interactions. And those complex trait interactions can, though, and this is the argument that I want to bring up, can be influenced through mediating those mechanisms fundamentally. Now, the problem that we have is that this is still very complex, but even if we manage it, we will run into the problems that we have costs that are associated with natural resistance. And those costs turn out to be primarily ecological costs that are mediated through the interaction with other organisms, organisms that we actually find very beneficial to our plants, for example, mutualists like predators and parasitoids that may be attracted to a plant, as well as pollinators, for example. And I will give you an example about that. The two examples that I want to focus in on is one example of a wild tomato, Solanum peruvianum, that we study in Peru, which is part of that project where we try to become more applied. And one is a wild system that grows in the agricultural niche, Solidago altissima, that is from the northeastern United States. And in both cases, and you know, because the time is relatively short, I want to focus on that information mediating system, volatile organic compound emission, and want to look at the ecological functions of herbivore-induced volatile emission in those two systems and what we can derive from those two systems for potential using in agriculture. So this is Solidago altissima in its native habitat, and you see they grow in these old field communities, and they tend to dominate those old field communities. So they produce almost monocultures of this particular species, Solidago altissima, and there are over 120 insect species associated with that plant and directly living off of that plant. But there's only two or three species that very efficiently affect the fitness of the plant and which primarily drive probably all the selection on those plants and influence the community composition. One of those important herbivores is this one. This beetle is a chrysomelid beetle called Trirapta virgata. And I focus my talk today on this species, but we do that analysis of the spatial distribution of herbivory in response to induced resistance in the plants for many different other species, but for the sake of time, I want to focus on this one today. So the first thing you have to know, what we find in that system, we find a very strong induced resistance, meaning that if we have plants that were previously damaged by Trirapta beetle larvae, and we put new Trirapta beetle larvae on them, we have a significantly lower growth rate on those plants. We measure growth rates because we have to take the beetles from the fields, though we don't have them in colony yet. So we have a very strong induced resistance. But most importantly, in that system, there's something very special, namely that the beetle larvae move away from the plants that they themselves damaged when they actually did relatively little damage to the plant. And thereby, it does not matter how much damage the plant actually received. So what you see here, the lines down here, represent plants that were damaged with 1, 3, or 7, or 11 beetle larvae for 1 week to manipulate different damage levels. And you see all of them are significantly different from the control that hadn't been damaged previously. And so what that means is it doesn't matter how much damage you have on the plant in this particular case, they will move faster away from the plants that were damaged as compared to those that were not damaged previously. That suggested that there is some kind of a threshold existing at which the induction is actually effective. And that threshold is relatively early with a very small plant damage. I want to just show that picture to show that there is a lot of significant changes going on in the secondary metabolite production. So this is an HPLC chromatogram, which is primarily including phenolic compounds, but there's a lot of terpenoid compounds, in particular diterpene glycosides and diterpenes like saponines that are very important in this plant. So there's a lot changing in the secondary metabolism. But most importantly, to come back to the threshold level suggestion, if we put differently aged larvae, this is first, I'm just representing here, first, second, and third instar larvae, on plants and wait until they leave themselves, then we get significant differences in how long they stay on the plant. Of course, the young ones stay longer on the plant than the older ones. But it turns out that the damage level at the time of leaving is almost exactly the same and is usually far below 10% total leaf tissue removal. And you have to know that Solidago altissima, you can only measure fitness effects of damage from 30% leaf damage on. So they drive the beetle, the plants drive the beetle larvae out long before an actual vital damage level is reached. Now, when the plants sort of move away from the plants that they have damaged, it turns out that they know exactly where they are going. So this is a set of choice experiments between damaged and undamaged plants. The first in a laboratory setting. And what we see there is they totally prefer undamaged plants over damaged plants. They do the same thing in the field. This is a more complicated experiment. I don't want to go into that into detail here, but we see exactly the same result. Now, because we work on volatiles, there was kind of the suggestion maybe they can smell the volatiles and already differentiate based on the volatile emission. So that means while they are sitting on the plant, they already know what's happening surrounding them, so they exactly know where to go, right? And so what we did was a field Y-tube experiment where we pulled air from damaged and undamaged plants through a Y-tube and had the larvae walk in the Y-tube. And you get exactly the same result surprisingly exactly the same result. So that the volatile emission alone explains most of the differences that we see in that system. So meaning in that particular case, the volatile emission mediates herbivore host choice, and in this case to the advantage of the plant, by moving the herbivore through the plant population, leading to an over dispersion of the herbivores in the plant population. Interestingly, this is not the only function of volatile emission in the system. We have, so this is just to show you a beautiful chromatogram. So people who work actually on volatile emission will agree that this is one of the most beautiful chromatograms you've ever seen. So in Goldenrod, you have this extreme response after damage, and you see, you know, a lot of peaks going up, a lot de novo produced, a lot much more produced in response to herbivory. So very clear signal. Interestingly, herbivory does not seem to play an important role in the control of that particular beetle. We have some suggestion that nematodes may play a role, but this is a specialized pentatomid bug that's feeding on those beetle larvae, and they don't seem to play an important role. However, there's an additional function of volatile emission in that system, namely plant-plant communication. So this is Kimberly Morrill, one of my PhD students, who started studying that, and what she found was that the plant standing next, so the, you know, the immediate neighbor of those damaged plants, induce resistance directly. So it's not simply primed, they induce them directly, and as a result, the beetle larvae move away from those only volatile exposed plants with the same probability that they move away from an actual damaged plant, which even more accelerates this over-dispersal behavior in the beetle population and reduces further the average damage that each plant receives in the population, right? Now, interestingly, this is now the agricultural interesting part of that. These plants grow normally relatively close together. And the effect that we see that the induced resistance has on the beetles results in that negative correlation between the number of overlapping leaves, which we use as a measure of isolation of the plants, with the leaf tissue damage that we find in average. And it's not immediately intuitive that you get a negative correlation here, but when I tell you that the beetle larvae never move down a plant and then up a plant again, they always move within the canopy. So the combination of standing close together with this very strong induced resistance helps the plants to spread the risk of herbivory across the entire population and therefore minimizes the effect on each single plant dramatically. We just did that same experiment in a more controlled way, so not as a correlated way, but we find exactly the same result. To conclude that first part of my talk, what we find is that Solidago altissima plants respond very strongly to Turritopter beetle damage. The beetles prefer undamaged plants as food and move through the plant population on the search for undamaged food plants using the volatile signal. So they have a very informed move through the plant population, and we get this kind of over-dispersal response. So induced chemical resistance in this case leads to a more even distribution of herbivory within the plant population, and induced resistance becomes a risk-spreading strategy in that case. And so from an applied perspective, one could very nicely apply that for crops where you don't sell the leaves, actually. So when you're only interested in seed production, for example, this could be very efficient. And the two points that have to be maximized in this particular case would be the induced response, so breeding for very strong induced resistance, as well as for the ability to perceive the neighbor's volatile signal. So these are the two core mechanisms that are important in that system and that make that system functioning so very well. Now, Mike is a little bit more of a negative example on wild tomatoes that we study in Peru on the western slope of the Andes, which is very dry habitat, a seasonal dry forest and very high elevations usually. All of the wild tomato species except of one are growing in Peru. And the study that I want to present to you, we work on several different wild tomato species, but the one that I want to show you today is Solanum peruvianum, which is one of the most widely distributed ones and one that is also used in plant breeding programs. So this plant is associated with a very diverse arthropod community. A lot of them are herbivores. And these are not even the major herbivores on this plant. The major herbivores are, in fact, whiteflies and thrips, which are also the major pests in tomato fields in Peru, and a real problem for the small farmers. In these plants, we found herbivore-induced secondary metabolite production, trypsin proteinase inhibitor induction, induced phenolic compound induction, and we know they have an induced, very strong induced volatile emission. And most importantly, they have induced resistance to most of the herbivores that we see in the picture. It turns out these plants are actually not very specific in their response, so it doesn't really matter what herbivore is feeding on them. They respond in the same way pretty much to anything that's feeding on the plant. Now, very important for understanding what I'm telling you today is that we also have a very diverse community of pollinators associated with those plants that are relatively specialized pollinators. So they have to cross-pollinate the flowers. Tomato flowers have closed anthocones that open to the inside, and pollen is the only reward that the pollinators get. They don't produce nectar. And so that means that they are specialized. The pollinators have to hang onto those anthocones and vibrate their wings in a certain frequency. The pollen shoots out and they can collect the pollen. Not all bees can do that. For example, honeybees are not able to do that. Right? That's why I'm saying this is a relatively specialized but very diverse of pollinator community. Now, while looking for correlations of resistance with fitness, we found this very interesting relationship. When we look at the proportion of damaged leaves as a measure of damage, and this could be actually relatively little damage, we're just measuring the number of leaves relative, the number of damaged leaves relative to the number of undamaged leaves in this case, and we plot them against the proportion of flowers with pollination marks. Pollination marks are these brown marks that are left after the bees actually had hooked onto those anthocones and vibrated their wings. So there isn't physical damage to those anthocones, and these brown spots is a phenol oxidase reaction that appears within 5 minutes, and it's a very sure sign that they had an actual buzzing event and very likely a pollination event. So it's a very secure measure of pollination success. So you see pollination success goes significantly down with the proportion of leaves damage, with the increased damage on the plant. This, interestingly, is also correlated with a reduced seed production, and in this case, a reduced food production. So there are two possibilities for why that could happen. So increased damage could just simply reduce the amount of resources available for the plant to allocate into fruit production, right? On the other hand, that link that we had with the pollinator attraction could mean that we have something like an induced pollinator limitation. And so we tried to establish a causal link between those two and made some detailed experiments, which are relatively simple experiments. So we had beetles damaging the plant, or we applied methylgesmate, which is one of the key hormones in the plant's wound response mechanism. In both cases, we get a dramatic reduction in the proportion of flowers of pollination marks. So we get a dramatic reduction in response to herbivory and in response to whatever chemical changes are induced in response to methylgesmate in pollinator attraction, right? This is directly translated in a smaller seed production or lower seed production per fruit on the plants in this particular case with the beetle damage. And I don't show you the data here, but we did combined experiments with methylgesmate where we actually have no damage on the plant. If we supplement the plant with pollen, we get actually a slightly higher production of seeds in the plants that are methylgesmate treated, suggesting that the entire reduction in seed production here is not due to allocation of resources or missing allocation of resources, but is in fact a herbivore-induced pollinator limitation. Now the question became, how do the pollinators know and how do they differentiate between damaged and undamaged plants? So this is how we do these experiments. They can be on very steep slopes, so the plants are down here. This is backs where the beetles are in and things like that. They can be very dangerous. So we trap volatiles from those plants, and we have a setup where we can trap up to 16 plants at a time with one pump, or 16 samples at one time. So we pull air through those chambers and pull them onto a charcoal trap that is later, where we later elute the compounds from and analyze them in GCMS. Now, if we compare volatile organic compound production between leaves and flowers, and damaged and undamaged plants, we have some certain very interesting results. First, focus your eyes on the first two chromatograms, which are leaves that were damaged by Manduca caterpillars or left as controls. And what you see is that we have significant amounts, primarily of mono and sesquiterpenes, that are strongly induced in response to damage. This is not a big surprise. A surprise to us was that there are compounds that are only produced by the flowers, and I say this is a surprise because to us the flowers smell exactly the same as the leaves. But the biggest surprise, and this is very novel, is that there were compounds that were only produced in the flowers and only in response to herbivory on the leaves. Right? So meaning that we have a potential signal that the pollinators may use as a signal to differentiate between damaged and undamaged plants. Now, in order to test that, we needed some kind of choice experiment. We were not allowed to take the bees out of the country, and we wanted to differentiate between the importance of visual and olfactorial cues. Now, we took advantage of the fact that if you damage leaves on a particular tomato plant, and you do that on different branches, these two branches are independent from each other. So that means if I do herbivore damage here, those flowers will smell differently, but here there's no change. It is like a control on the same plant. So we can take advantage of that fact and can bring the two inflorescences together, with the hypothesis being that if olfactorial cues play a role, which, you know, in that combination, the pollinators would only perceive odor cues that are damaged, right? If olfactorial cues play an important role, then they would always avoid the ones with flowers of damaged plants, right? And we went actually one step further and covered the inflorescences on the branch that was damaged to expose them only to the volatile cue from damaged plants, but the flowers from undamaged plants, right? So if we do that, we get a very clear result. So in both cases, whether or not they are open or closed, we get a dramatic reduction, again, in the proportion of pollination marks, suggesting that the induced volatile emission from the plants themselves are the cues that the pollinators use to differentiate between damaged and undamaged plants. And actually, we did more precise experiments to figure out where the odor source is coming from, and it turns out it is, in fact, the leaf damage-induced floral volatile emission that does it. So it's the floral volatile emission, not the leaf volatile emission, that the pollinators use as a cue. Now, to conclude that last part, so we see induced resistance to herbivores in those wild tomatoes. We have herbivory-induced pollinator limitation. The pollinators use the volatile cues during foraging for pollen. And this is a clear sign of an ecological cause. This is what I was talking about in the beginning. It's an ecological cause of induced resistance, and it's more specifically an ecological cost of induced volatile emission. And this is something we could always run into if we have plants that are dependent on pollinators. And so for plant breeding programs, this could be, in fact, a problem. But it could even be a problem for those that not necessarily need pollinators, because we have quite a few examples where the fruit size and the fruit development is actually larger when you have pollinators present, even though the plants don't necessarily need pollinators. And tomato is actually a very good example. So you get much better fruit production if you have pollinators, even though the domesticated tomato is self-compatible. Now, with that, I'm almost at the end of my talk, but even with the risk of sounding trivial, I want to sort of conclude what we can actually take home for agricultural systems. Because the systems are complex, and I want to come back to that over and over again, if we don't use spraying and pretty much take out complexity, if we have those complex systems, we have to know the possible interactions. So we have to focus on the interaction, not on what the single species do, really. We have to focus on the interaction. We have to know the factors, which could be partially the species that are interacting, the factors affecting the interaction, and after those factors to minimize and alter those factors to minimize herbivore effect and maximize the effect on the natural enemies, for example, on the plant. We have to accept some damage, so this only works if we either change consumer preferences or if we use these kinds of applications only in crops that where the leaf damage doesn't matter at all. And one thing that we do a lot of research in my lab on that I didn't touch on at all today is responses that plants have to herbivory that are called overcompensatory responses, meaning that when herbivore is in the system, we get actually higher yield. And I want to refer to one paper that we did in collaboration with a Colombian group, which includes my wife actually, on potatoes, where we actually get a 2.5 times higher production of potato yield when a major crop pest is in the system, right? And so we can play around with that too, in addition to what I mentioned earlier, the competition, and in combination with the herbivore-induced responses. And these are the people and the funding agencies involved, and I'm not sure if we have still time for a few questions. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much for that wonderful question, because this is one of our major research parts right now, so the actual functional reason for why the pollinators avoid the pollen. Originally, we thought the pollen quality is going down, and we have found that in other tomato species, but not in Peruvianum. So in Peruvianum, the pollen quality seems to stay the same in response to herbivory. The other possibility is that there are additional predators attracted to the plant with a volatile emission that also affect the pollinators. So it's the second hypothesis. And the third hypothesis, which is the one that we favor the most at the moment, is that the pollinators use volatile emission as a constancy cue, meaning that if you have most of the plants undamaged in the entire population, which in most of our experiments was because we wanted to manipulate damage, right? And so in our subpopulation of damaged and undamaged plants, we always had an equal distribution of damaged and undamaged. Right, but the entire population was, in average, undamaged. And so that means they go in, and it's a density-dependent effect, the pollinators go for what they learned first. Right? And they use, and this is we have some evidence for that, actually. So this is, right now, the strongest hypothesis that we have, that they use it as a constancy cue, but it still becomes a cost of an induced resistance, right? Which is density-dependent, though.
Do you have time for a last question? Yes, Steve? Do you
have a proportion of oligolytic and pollinating pollinators that were hymenoptera that you have in your selected species?
Well, I think they're all polylactic. The thing is, in the time, this is hard to answer because we primarily do our experiments in the tri-season, yeah. But you have to know that the wild tomatoes are usually, you know, among the four or five species of flowering plants that actually flower during the tri season. But they will flower throughout the tri and the wet season. That means in the tri season, they become almost the sole source for pollen for most of the pollinators there. Right. Yeah. Right. But in the tri season, you're totally right. So in the tri season, that makes total sense, right? And it becomes a cost. In the wet season, it may be different. And the question is in which direction it may be different. It could actually be even more pronounced, right?
yeah, maybe a last question you have.
That's a wonderful question. I can just give you an example for what happens then, actually, when most of the plants are damaged, most of the Altissima plants, which is actually the preferred food for them, most of the Solidago Altissima plants are damaged, they actually tend to jump onto other Solidago species. So that means that the induced resistance in Solidago Altissima is even worse than the differences between two different species. Right? So this is, and I think this is almost unheard of. So I had no contact with any system where we had so strong induced resistance, first, that it drives the herbivore out that is actually starting the feeding, right? They usually stay. Usually induced resistance prevents an additional herbivore coming in, right, if it's very good. But in this case, they drive them out, and the quality seems to be, in average, so bad that they even choose a different plant species over the preferred one eventually.
Thank you. Thank you, André.
Thank you.